Deep in the farthest recesses of the most distant jungle lies a city. A city populated by the most mysterious, terrifying, and downright grotesque denizens ever seen by mortal eye. Here, in the darkened corners of this cavernous locale, sits an ordinary, average brick building with an innocuous, ordinary, average blinking neon sign which reads, On Air. It is here where each week, Seth Breedlove and Mark Matzke convene to discuss the greatest mysteries the world has ever known. Now, strap on your hiking boots, grab your trusty walking stick, and don't forget the bug spray as we begin our journey through Monsteropolis.
This is, I'm watching Mark fool with his new microphone. I don't know what happened to that thing.
I feel like this has happened before.
It's those, they're cheap pop. This is, this is Monsteropolis, a show about monsters, legends, and anomalies. I'm one of your hosts. You want me to turn your mic down? Are you good?
I'm good, I think.
I'm one of your hosts. My name is Seth Breedlove. I'm joined by my pal...
who's currently getting hit in the face,
beamed
by
in the head,
a pop filter, Mark Matzke. Hello,
Matzke. Hi.
Oh, there we go. No,
no. See, it's not that. It's this right here. I think.
Oh,
this thing is loose. I would just
there.
Okay. This is a show about monsters, legends, and anomalies. We are the official podcast of Small Town Monsters. I have an announcement to make that I can tell you about.
Cool.
This is going to be the first time I announce this or talk about this anywhere too. So, we have coming up, this weekend, Western Pennsylvania Conference on the Unexplained. We're showing Invasion on Chestnut Ridge and Momo, the Missouri Monster. Mark will be there. Are you there all weekend?
I'm there all weekend.
Okay, Mark's there all weekend. And Andy will be there.
Yes, representing.
So we're showing Invasion on Chestnut Ridge on Saturday. Can't remember the time. I don't know. And then on Sunday, we're showing Momo at another undisclosed time, which I forget. But Stan Gordon will be there, Eric Altman, Nick Redfern, a lot of other people. There's a lot of people. We'll
the cast
be there.
Of Mountain Monsters,
the
too.
Monsters.
I've been commissioned by various people to take pictures of the Mountain Monsters gang.
Yeah, because it's hard to find them at.
Yeah.
To get pictures.
It is.
I'll tell you this. Wild Bill, very nice man. Crazy. Not he's crazy, but crazy enough. He lived in this area. He said he overheard me talking about, we were at CryptidCon, and he said he overheard me telling someone that I was in Wadsworth. And he's like, hey man, I used to live out in Rittman. So he's lived like 5 minutes away. And we were talking about like restaurants in the area and stuff. So really nice guy. We talked about our love for the Manor. Down in Strasbourg, which one of my favorite restaurants on earth. So it was good. It was cool. He seems like a very, very,
very
nice guy.
To observe those gentlemen.
Mm-hmm. They're genuinely, nice guys. Their show's bogus.
It's a show.
Yeah. But you know, unlike a lot of people, I'm pretty good about separating people from the things they're involved in. So it's not a, they're very nice is what I was going to
say.
Yeah. I'll just end on that thought. Announcement. For listeners, just real quick, if there's an episode that seems especially scatterbrained, it's because the way we record the show is we'll go like 3-4 weeks without recording anything. And then we're back together and it's kind of like, I have to readjust or figure out again. It's relearning what we're doing every single time we do it. So that's part of my brain is all over the map right now too. So the announcement, March 21st, Canton Palace Theater, Mysteries and Monsters, a Small Town Monsters event.
Whoa.
It will be an all day event at the Canton Palace Theater, Saturday, March 21st.
Whoa.
We're going to do a special 5-year anniversary screening of Minerva Monster.
Is it the special edition with CGI with additions?
It's added French gold sequence. No, I'm just kidding. I think it's just going to be the Blu-ray version of the movie. So it's a very high resolution version of Minerva Monster, but it's still the same amateurish wasteland that is Minerva Monster. I'm sorry.
So bring your friends.
Bring everybody. That'll probably be the first event of the day. And then we have not figured out exactly what else is happening. We do know Shannon LeGros is going to be there. We'll try to get Adam up, the Matskys, obviously. But I am going to try to push and get some other speakers, because this isn't going to be just movies. It's going to be a one-day conference, cool. Essentially. So it's Mysteries and Monsters at the Canton Palace Theater, Saturday, March 21st. I do not have ticket prices yet. I'm going to keep them under $20.
You think we can get Alexander out for that?
We could probably get Alexander out and have him talk, maybe even show an episode of On the Trail of Chamber or something, have him talk. And Alexander is going to features pretty prominently. Well, you've seen episode two. He features throughout, but he's got a really great interview we did with him for On the Trail of UFOs as well. But we're going to, okay. So the day is going to start with Minerva Monster. And then the big news is that it will end with the world premiere of the entire On the Trail of UFOs series. So we're going to show every episode of On the Trail of UFOs. Hopefully I will cut out, opening and ending credits of each episode, and that way we can kind of, you know, go through, but we'll definitely have some sort of intermission, because the series as a whole is probably going to be somewhere around 5-6 hours long. So
it's like a binge watch event.
So it really is. And I'm not sure yet what time that particular part of the day will start, but I'm thinking like 6 or 7, and then it'll just go until it ends. But it's going to be an all-day event, and all the Small Town Monsters crew will be there, and we are definitely going to try to get some special guests in. My current thinking is to get the Ohio MUFON in, because I really like Thomas as a speaker, and he's super interesting, and I love that Portage County UFO chase story, and maybe have him talk about that in a presentation. Cool. But yeah, it's going to, we locked it down. This is locked down, so we're definitely doing it. I just have to get pricing information figured out. But again, the pricing is going to be cheap. It's not going to be what you normally would pay for an all-day event, especially one being held at the notoriously haunted Canton Palace Theater. Oh, the other thing we're going to try to do, and I, again, can't guarantee this, but we're either getting a food truck or we'll have someone set up upstairs. This is actually what gave us the idea to do this, was when we did the last screening at the Palace, they kept coming up to me and talking to me about how we need to do some sort of like dinner there, because they have this whole second floor up in the balcony area where there's like a bar set up, and like you can set food on it and all kinds of stuff, and there's table area up there. So that's what we're going to do. There's probably going to be a couple vendors, nothing crazy, but we'll probably have one or two vendors set up in addition to us. But yes, it's Mysteries and Monsters, Canton Palace Theater, featuring a 5-year anniversary screening of Minerva Monster and the world premiere of On the Trail of UFOs. And we will have guest speakers throughout the day.
I wonder if we could get Barbara for that.
Yeah.
She generally seems for such things.
Hoping for would be a Q&A with Barbara and maybe James Shannon, and have you MC it or something like that. And then hopefully get you to do your Peninsula Python presentation as well sometime throughout the day. But we just have to get, again, this is all being figured out on the fly right now. We just got everything locked down this past week. So make plans. If you're in the general area, make plans to be there. If we have enough people telling us they're traveling from out of the area, I'll try to get some sort of hotel deal worked out where people can stay at a local hotel and get money off or something, you know, like some sort of discount. We'll try to get a room block is what I'm saying. We have an email. You want to read it?
Oh,
you're good at reading things.
Okay. Oh yes. This is from our buddy, Matt. Hey, hey, my dudes, I'm so excited. You're all reunited. Before I started the episode, I had that Peaches and Herb song playing, so I thought that was fitting.
I don't know that song.
Oh, yeah, you do. Reunited and it feels so good.
Uh-uh.
You don't know that?
No.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
That should be the bumper music.
All right. I'm sure I can clear those licenses. Yeah, I'm sure.
Yes. So I know you cover cryptids and paranormal along with STM material, but those Missing People episodes are top notch. I love reading and listening to true crime stuff. I'm like a flipping wiki on the macabre. That's just fun to say. Mm-hmm. You should read that sentence out loud.
Flipping wiki.
Flipping.
It's hard to flipping wiki on the macabre. Oh,
have you thought about doing an episode on monsters of a different sort, the crimes and psychology of humans? Mm. Anyway, miss you dudes. Hope all is well.
Haven't we had someone ask us the same thing or we talked about it or something?
Yeah, it comes up every so often about missing people, true crime. Oh, serial killers often gets brought up as,
yeah.
Well, you guys do a full-blown doc about serial killers.
Well, and I think we talked about it on the show. At one point, Terror in the Skies was the third film in the Monsters of the Midwest trilogy. It was originally supposed to be a movie about Belle Gunness, who was sort of one of America's first serial killers. And she was definitely the first female serial killer in America, but, you know, supposedly killed over like 40 people. Really interesting story. And it did have some correlations to like the paranormal because she was seen for years after she supposedly died. Mm. Like people would claim they saw her. So it was kind of like a Bigfoot situation. People would take pictures of what they thought was her and stuff like that. And they're still not sure that the person buried in her grave is actually her. So it's a really, really creepy. Interesting. That
crosses the streams of a couple different things.
Yeah, it does. It? Yeah. And, we had meetings, production meetings about that movie. We didn't have a title, but, we had a production meeting at a Denny's. I'm dead serious. It was Jason, Zach, me, and Santino. Mm-hmm. And the big reason we had it was to discuss if it was even possible to do something with the recreations and things like that for a movie about Belle Gunness.
Where did that happen? Not the Denny's.
I was going to say at Arlington Road in Akron is the Denny's. It's Indiana. What is the name? Shoot. I completely blanked on the name.
So
the town. Yeah.
Interesting though.
Yeah. It would have been the final, it would have been the middle chapter in the Midwest trilogy.
And you decided not to,
we did Terror in the Skies
instead.
Yeah. Part of it was just a concern that we would lose our audience. Like they would, you know, they might not be along for that ride. Mm-hmm. So we did not. Yeah. We didn't do that one. I would circle back to that at some point. I talked to Shannon even about doing On the Trail of Serial Killers or something like that and tracking, you know, but I mean, I'm a wuss and I'm a noted wuss, Seth Breedlove. I'm kind of like, I'm not super into true crime, I don't think. And yet, like, if you looked at the documentaries I've watched over the last like 3 years, all my favorite ones are true crime. I really love that Evil Genius doc on Netflix, and The Keepers was probably one of my favorite anything over the last 5 years. So a lot of that stuff is true crime.
What was the one about the stuff that happened in Erie?
You know, that's Evil Genius.
That's Evil Genius. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a really good one. Mm-hmm. I actually did a class at the Wadsworth Public Library about filmmaking, and I used that as a sort of a case study in why visuals don't necessarily play a role in a film's success, and how it's all about the storytelling, because that is a really interesting story, but visually it was astonishingly, I don't want to say amateurish, but it definitely wasn't like glossy or what you typically see from a Netflix doc. It just seemed like, you know, like it reminded me in some ways of like Minerva, just visually. And but they told the story so well. Anyway, this episode's about, did you have something else to
well,
add?
Well, I guess, you know, is in terms of the subject matter.
Oh, yeah.
Well, two things.
Yes.
First, the subject matter itself, that's not like my go-to. Mm-hmm. I've got free time, so I'm going to read a book about true crime, but I can get very interested in it.
Yeah.
Like when we were doing the missing persons thing and getting into the Cleveland abductions and the guy who had like multiple women in his basement
and
stuff.
Yeah.
I can get very into that and almost disturbing way, like too interested almost.
Yeah.
So like, you have to be like careful
trying,
with that.
You're trying to learn.
What do I do? Refine my technique. Yeah. But yeah.
I agree.
It's weird. Thing that bothers me, yeah. I'll say this and then move on to my other point. Thing that bothers me is some of the podcasts and stuff, or just promotional things that I hear about people who are almost gleefully talking about.
That's my issue.
Murder and true crime and stuff like that. That gets under my skin a little bit. Not easy with that.
Or like when people capitalize on missing people by creating a franchise out of it. Let's move on.
Thank you, Math, for writing.
Definitely.
And check out Moth Boys podcast. Yeah. Those guys are a real up-and-coming crew over there.
And we're going to be with them
this
weekend. They'll be at the Western Conference, Western PA Conference of the Unexplained. And also, like, we're trying to... So Matt's had some experiences that relate to On the Trail of UFOs. So if we do a final leg of filming, I think we might actually be interviewing Matt. So that would be cool. This episode's about black triangles.
Yes.
Black triangles. And just triangular craft. Mm-hmm. Which is great because I finished a rough, very rough cut of episode 2 of On the Trail of UFOs, and it's all about craft descriptions throughout the years, UFO descriptions throughout the years. And I realized there's more to the phenomenon than craft, there's also going to be a Ghost Lights episode, which I'm actually very excited about because that's something I've been really into for a very long time.
Sure. Yep.
Triangular UFOs, gained notoriety in the 80s. Mostly due to the Hudson Valley, New York flap. And for listeners who don't know about Hudson Valley, we should probably do an entire episode or two about the Hudson Valley and just what all took place there. And there's going to be a very heavy focus on it in episode 3 or 4 of On the Trail of UFOs as well, because we interviewed Linda Zimmerman and we interviewed a witness in the area. And but for listeners who don't know, do you want to give a synopsis of the Hudson Valley stuff?
You go ahead, because you're right. Just having
been
there.
I feel like
I'm
talking too much on this episode. So Hudson Valley, New York, it's actually one of my favorite places. It feels very New England. I don't know if it qualifies as New England, but I call it New England. I also had a wonderful breakfast in Goshen, New York. I don't even know if I told you about this place.
No.
Where we had to like crawl between. We walked into this. I'm sorry, listeners. Again, we went into this tiny diner that sits on the end of a street in downtown Goshen, which is very New England looking small town.
Mm-hmm.
And we walk in, there's like 8 tables, if that. There might've been less tables. We had to wait for like a half hour to get a seat because there were so few tables. But I asked that there was a bathroom, and she points to where it's not really a kitchen. There's a grill and all this stuff, you know, like, but it's out. It's kind of like in the restaurant. And she's like, it's between the refrigerator and the oven. And I look and like, sure enough, there's like a doorway. And I'm like, okay. So I go walking through this doorway and there's steps leading down into this basement. And I'm not kidding. You couldn't stand up. You were down in this like little basement hunched over. The bathroom was like a toilet behind half of a door. So there was no floor. It didn't go to the door didn't go anywhere near the floor. I mean, like if someone walked down there, they would see your knees. And yeah. So anyway, that place was amazing. And I love Goshen, New York, but anyway, 1980s.
How was the food?
It was one of the best breakfast sandwiches I've ever had. It was
really,
I got a breakfast sandwich that was a poppy seed bagel with, over easy eggs and bacon and American cheese and tomato, and it was incredible.
See, this and is their the home essence, fries, right? Yeah. Oh, really,
dude? Their home fries. I told Adrian I would take her there. I would take her back to the Hudson Valley just to go to this restaurant.
Nice.
Yeah, it was one of the best breakfasts I've ever had on one of these shoots. But anyway, Hudson Valley, New York, the 1980s. There was a 9-year, seven to 11 year flap, depending on who you talk to. I think Linda says 9 years. But in other reading I've done, there's a lot of people who say it was an 11 year flap, and there's some people who say it hasn't stopped. So it gained notoriety because of the, a number of TV shows did episodes that either focused on it or sort of had it, you know, like somewhere within the episodes. The most famous is Unsolved Mysteries. They did a great episode with really cool effects, by the way. I don't know if it works so well because it was night or mm-hmm. what, but like these were really early CG days and it works so well.
Yeah.
Like it works really well. But it's basically there were triangular craft seen all over the Hudson Valley for 7 to 11 years. And there were other craft seen as well. And there's a long history in the Hudson Valley that we're going to get into, going back all the way to the earliest settlers of strange lights in the sky. Pig shaped UFOs. You ever hear that?
I have never heard that before. Yeah. No.
Cigar.
Yes.
It's a cigar shape.
Okay.
They would refer to them as swine shaped.
Huh.
But it's shaped like a cigar. It's really interesting. We have some yeah. early stories that we're going to get into. A very early abduction story from 1638 that'll be in the abduction episode too. I promise I'm not just trying to hard sell On the Trail of UFOs. I've been nerding out over a yeah. lot of this stuff. But yeah, there were sightings all over the Hudson Valley. Military personnel saw these things, policemen, firefighters. There's a great story that's in episode 2 of On the Trail of UFOs where Linda talks about a New York City fire department guy who saw one of these black triangles go over his house, went outside, flashed his a very powerful flashlight at it, and all the lights shut off. What I cut out and what will probably be added in another episode is for months after that, he was finding or seeing lights in the woods then every night. And he would try to like sneak out there because apparently he had been in Vietnam and had jungle training. And he would try to sneak out and catch them. And once he did, and then they never came back. So really, really cool story. But all sorts of sightings over this area. Mm-hmm. When I say all sorts of, I mean thousands, not like a couple hundred or 50, 60. There are literally thousands of people that claim to have seen things.
And many of those were multiple witnesses, right?
Yes. I mean, yeah. And a lot of them were police. That's mm-hmm. what we discovered is like there were chases, like Portage County type chases mm-hmm. of these black triangles. And that's the point where the black triangles become popular. It's like you can point to the 80s and the Hudson Valley stuff. And obviously we can talk a little bit about Phoenix as well at some point in mm-hmm. this episode. But for now, I think I'll let you start out talking about black triangles so yeah. I can shut up.
Well, and then in the popular culture, which had been dominated by discs, right? Mm-hmm. Flying saucers.
Yeah.
In the 80s, then there is a transition even in pop culture to triangular shaped craft. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, one very large responsible party for that is the X-Files.
Oh, yeah.
Because they would routinely show the, if not a whole triangular craft, a big solid silent object in the sky, and they were not relying on the saucers or even a metallic looking craft. Typically, I mean, they would have the triangular shape float over, send a beam down. I mean, all of you could tell that Chris Carter was up on his
yeah. What year reports. Did X-Files kick off?
That would have been
89 or 91,
90, yeah, early 90s. So, like, 94 was season 2.
Okay. So
93 would be,
I was real close.
Yeah.
89 or 91. so 4 years prior to, or 3 years. Yeah. 4 years prior to Phoenix, which is the one that sort of put it on a national mm-hmm. scale, but following the Hudson Valley stuff. So I would assume he was up on that kind of lore.
Yes.
All right.
Yeah. So, for research purposes, you know, there was a letter in one of our previous episodes that referenced Triangular UFOs, an Estimate of the Situation by David Marler, with a foreword by John B. Alexander. And so it's really very well done. It's super sober-minded, scientific, just hard data all throughout this book. And the first thing that caught my attention in Marler's research is compiling different types of objects cited. So there's this chart that's in the book that has a huge number of descriptors of reports that have come into the, and I don't, Oh, National UFO New Reporting Fork. Center.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is located up in that new, Peter Davenport's up in that.
Peter Davenport, yeah, right. He's on coast every week.
Really?
Coast to Coast AM.
I didn't know that.
Has about a 5-minute segment every week where he talks about what's come in recently.
It's funny MUFON gets all the press because I feel like New Fork is what's referenced far more, and their data, their reports are much more easily accessible. Mm. MUFON, you have to be I joined the MUFON database just so I could get access to the files. But as far as I know, New Fork's just out there, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So they go through this list and just a few examples. I mean, crescent shaped cylinder, diamond, fireball, hexagon, pyramid, round, sphere, and of course, circular or disc. And in Marler's compilation, the thing that jumps off the page is that triangle outweighs any other category. Mm. You know, the next closest is...
Have a numbers on that?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
What is it?
Well, to give you a sense of it, and this is excluding just the generic light. So a light in the
right,
sky.
Right, in the sky, yeah.
Leaving that out. The second highest number is disc at 2,439. Triangle is 2,782.
Jeez.
Which, that shocked me, I guess. I was surprised by that stat. You know, yeah. I would have just assumed after light it would be flying disc or oblong shape.
Yeah.
And it's not. It's the triangle.
Where's diamond at on that list?
Diamond is the diamond. 456.
All right. We gotta step it up.
There's no pig on here either.
Oh, darn.
Disappointing.
Swine-shaped. Yeah.
But like going down the list, circle is 2,233.
Mm-hmm. And that's like a literal flying circle? Or
yeah, that's distinct from...
Like a mini Death Star flying around?
Oh.
So that'd be pretty sweet.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess so. This is a pure circle.
Yeah.
Because you have other, disc, which I assume is circular, yeah, but is flying.
Flying saucer, yeah.
Flat instead of just a circle in the sky. So that was really, you know, and then to give you a sense, that's discounting light, but light comes in at 5,509.
Hmm.
So by far, the most... frequently reported unidentified flying object is just a light of some sort. And then, you know, but as far as solid objects go, a triangle seems to be outpacing everything else.
Now, these episodes always get dicey for me because I hate when you take someone else's writing and kind of like just recite what they're writing in their book. But I'm going to do a little bit of that in this episode, but I want to keep mentioning the name of this, but what's the name of this book?
Triangular
UFOs, An Estimate of the Situation by David Marler. And I was actually turned on to this book by Rojas, Alejandro Rojas, when we did an interview with him back in July. So I knew of this book, and he mentioned this book in his interview in episode 2 as well. But one thing he had said that stuck out to me was that the triangular UFOs are being reported now, but there is a history of triangle UFOs. So the first thing I did when I cracked the book open was actually just skip to the history stuff, because sure, that's the stuff, right, I find the most interesting. And I'm going to talk about this first sighting and then mention something else he talks about. But literally the first thing he talks about in the chapter is a report from April 28th, 1953. So you're, a few decades before the triangular UFO rises to prominence. This is literally me reading his book. Just FYI, I did not write these words. The gist of the article focuses on UFO research conducted by one of the teachers at the University of Wisconsin. Helmuth Engelmann is described in the article as a jet course instructor for the university, focusing on jet engine design and propulsion characteristics. In his spare time, he researched and lectured on the UFO subject. He related in the article that one of his non-believer students eventually became a believer. He stated that the student sent him a letter some months back that related a bizarre encounter with an unidentified flying object while driving on the fittingly, the Pennsylvania Turnpike. Mm-hmm. One morning, the student is quoted as saying it was triangular in shape, resembling the type which was first reported over the Dutch East Indies in 1890 and which caused the Great Flying Triangle Scare in England in 1894. So that set him off on this path of trying to find those reports, mainly the 1890 and 1894 scares. Apparently he found the 1890 stuff in Charles Fort's Book of the Damned. He relates, in reviewing my copy of the Book of the Damned, I came across several intriguing reports. Despite the fact they are not references to what the newspaper article alludes to, they should be mentioned here in the context of our discussion. And he talks about, See, this is why I hate the way I take notes. Anyway, he finds there were reports in 1890, and then he finds 1894, the string of sightings in the East Indies of triangular shaped craft. And apparently, like, someone went and interviewed witnesses because they were all sort of talking about the same thing. Let me see if I can find, because he actually, yeah, right here. Okay, so he found this in Donald Kehoe's The Flying Saucers Are Real, which was published in 1950. So just a few years prior to actually when some of this was happening, when this guy talked about this. In New Zealand, a year later, an oval-shaped disc was reported speeding high overhead. This was on May 4th, 1888. About 2 years after this, several large aerial bodies were sighted hovering over the Dutch East Indies. Most accounts describe them as roughly triangular, about 100 feet on the base and 200 feet on the sides. Some observers thought they might be longer and narrower. And then he goes on August 26, 1894, and these two sections I'm reading here are from Flying Saucers Are Real by Kehoe. On August 26, 1894, a British admiral reported sighting a large disc with a projection like a tail. And a year after this, both England and Scotland buzzed with stories of triangular-shaped objects like those seen in the Dutch East Indies. Although many officials scoffed at the stories, more than one astronomer stuck to his belief that the mysterious things might be coming from outer space. Since planes and dirigibles were then unknown, there was no one on Earth who could have been responsible for them. So the late 1800s, there's at least two slight flaps, I guess you could call them. The only thing about it is it seems like they're not verifiable. It seems, I mean, not just because it took place so long ago, but even in the writing of Kehoe's book and Fort's book, it seems like he wasn't necessarily verifying them. They're kind of mentioning random.
Purely anecdotal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, I guess it's interesting that even back then they were talking about triangular shaped UFOs at a time when late 1800s like that. I mean, airships were what people were primarily seeing. Mm-hmm. There weren't reports of really many reports of flying discs, let alone triangular craft seen overhead.
Right. Yeah, they were limited just by what they could observe.
Yeah.
And it wasn't conditioned at all.
It right.
Looks like a triangle up there. Yeah, what I thought was cool too was the reports that he pulled out of the 40s and 50s and 60s to some degree. And you had, at that point, a lot of military eyewitnesses, in particular pilots, for somewhat obvious reasons, but they were observing both the size and the rate of speed and the unusual movements. And these are people who are trained to observe aerial, you know, phenomena. And in particular, it seems like 1960, there's a string of old clippings that's in the book that's heavily influenced by the military observance of those. It's in Project Blue Book.
And I might have saved some of that.
Yeah.
Because let me see. I took notes on all this. But there's is that Goose Bay Labrador on June 29th, 1954?
Yeah, I think that's the pilot.
Where another triangular UFO was sighting. This time it was witnessed by 11 crew members of a British Overseas Airways Corporation Stratocruiser, and most of the 51 passengers for a full 18 minutes. Okay, this isn't the one I thought. I know what you're talking about because I saved those too. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I that was surprising to me, because to me this is a very modern thing, but it seems like the 50s and 60s there was actually a pretty decent amount of them. I don't know what the exact date is on this, but this was a newspaper clipping, and it's a newspaper clipping that's in the book. From in it just says, 1953. Look out, here come the flying triangles. Mrs. Ruby Little telephoned the sheriff's Montrose station excitedly yesterday and said she saw one when she looked from her kitchen window. Then it gives her address. Does that make sense? The thing was flying north at a slow speed. It's light colored and has a gondola shaped body attached. She told Sergeant PC Newman, it's between 5,000 and 10,000 feet up. And I know it isn't a kite or a weather balloon or a plane because I'm familiar with all those. The triangle was about the size of a large plane, Mrs. Little said, but she didn't notice any spacemen aboard. There was no sound of any engine. From Salem come dispatches describing how former Crown Prince Otto of Austria told a town hall audience he thinks the flying saucers seen over the United States are Russian map recording devices. And there's another 1950s one, the report from the Daily Gazette in Berkeley, California. The title was called Saucers Outmoded, Texans Sight Flying Arrowhead. And it, again, like one of my favorite things about historical reports like this is when you get into the reports where they are they're putting things in a context they understand at that time. Mm-hmm. So calling it an arrowhead is kind of cool.
Yeah.
Because it's Texas,
yeah, sure,
in the 1950s. Mm-hmm. And that's what they're going to call it, as an arrow, a flying arrowhead.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's cool.
Yeah. And there's another report. This is September 15th, 1960. Where they're in the body of the report itself, they're talking about this shift. Mm-hmm. It reminded me of that. It's Los Angeles, California. Mm. A police officer says he saw a flying triangle this morning. That's right, triangle, not saucer. So they're even editorializing, yeah, yeah, as they're writing the report.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a kind of a boilerplate report. Triangular shaped dark object traveling in northeasterly direction, 1,000 feet at a slow rate of speed. And that's something we'll talk about. We talk about characteristics of these craft, is that they often move slowly and even stop and seem to hover in place, typically not making much of a sound. And at the same time, then they can move off at a very, you know, unspeakably high rate of speed.
Yeah. And that's something that kept coming up The Hudson Valley flap's interesting because they almost seemingly hovered in place. Like they mm-hmm. they come into an area and then they kind of hover in place, but they can take off, like you said, like at a ridiculous rate of speed. And then that ties to, so there's three things I noticed in editing this episode of On the Trail of UFOs, not this episode of the podcast, but one, the airships and the triangles are much more alike than people maybe realize, in that They show up and they seemingly want to be seen. Mm-hmm. Like the airships from the 1890s would come into a place and they would hover overhead, and occasionally people would meet the occupants. And but they also had these bright spotlights that they would scan the skies, which reminds me of Phoenix, where you had these lights that were like very noticeable that people saw. One thing that Lynn said that Linda also said, without having any knowledge of the other saying this, is that it's almost like a parade. That was how Lynn put the Phoenix lights. It was like they were on parade over the city of Phoenix. Mm. You know, like this mile wide craft or whatever moves right through the sky, and it does so very slowly over a major area, urban area.
And the route that it took seemed to
put it right over, yeah, right where you would be seen.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something I noticed in reading, but also looking at this episode, is like the airships and the triangles are the only ones that behave that way not every time, but the bulk of the times. Like people see flying saucers, but they're not hanging out overhead necessarily. And then, you know, like taking a slow jaunt over New York City or something, right? Like these mile wide craft or whatever, it's almost like they're on parade, like they want to be seen. Yeah. So I thought that was an sure. interesting correlation between the airships and the triangles.
Yeah. Another point of comparison might be that they both seem to be undeniably physical craft, mm-hmm. you know, as opposed to just a light or something that yeah. blinks in or out. These, you know, the people went aboard the airships,
yeah.
you know,
yeah,
and occupants talked to them and things like that. And the triangles as well. I'm not familiar with any reports where they just sort of wink out.
Yeah.
They're going somewhere.
Yeah.
When they leave, you watch them depart. So that's another thing. And that's something Marler does make a point of, is that when he's talking about these black triangular ships, they do appear to be physical made craft. You know, they're not some electromagnetic.
Yeah.
Or you know, some paraphysical thing.
Sean Kevin Jason, who witnessed a black triangle outside of somewhere between in the desert between Las Vegas and Area 51, he witnessed a massive triangular craft. And like his opinion was it was piloted by people, like it was people that were on it. It was some mm-hmm. sort of experimental craft. So the thing is like a mile wide. If that's true, like the mile wide craft thing, that's downright spooky. But I mean, that does tie back to the Hudson Valley, in that some of those craft that were seen in the Hudson Valley were said to be massive, mm-hmm. like just massive. So yeah, this is a really the different craft descriptions to me is like has become one of my favorite aspects of ufology, just in this kind of like brief time I've been getting back into all this, because I notice similarities between behavior, like the airships and the triangles is the thing that jumps to mind. But I just think some of that stuff is really interesting.
Do you want to get into the description?
Yeah.
Of the craft?
Yeah, really? We probably should do that quickly. Before we end.
Yeah, okay. So, you know, as you were talking about, mm-hmm. one of the things that really the triangles seem to have in common is their large size. And it's anywhere from a mile, several hundred feet. A very common descriptor is the size of a football field. So, in other words, whatever is up there is really huge. And Marler makes this list of primary characteristics. That's one, large size. Beams of light emitted, either a spotlight that shines down to the ground or laser-like beams shining down. One's like a spotlight, the other is more laser-like. And that, in that case, it's either down to the ground, or if there's multiple craft, those lights go back and forth between triangular ships. Hmm. Three bright lights, one at each point. So the points of the triangle, you've got a bright light at each end or each point. Mm-hmm. Ability to hover, we mentioned that before. The ability to make flat turns. In doing this, they do not exhibit the characteristic roll or tilting that normal aircraft display. So they just turn when they want to turn, yeah. without a airborne tilt. Silent flight. Compared to conventional aircraft, these objects are often notorious for emitting no noise whatsoever. Slow speed, we kind of touched on that before. Low altitude flight, and he writes, a characteristic that lends the close encounters with these objects is being extremely low in altitude. In majority of cases, the altitude of these objects is often 500 to 1,000 feet above witnesses' heads. Sharp turns at high speed and rapid acceleration. So we did touch on quite a few mm-hmm. of the primary characteristics. Secondary ones, real quickly, they can sometimes have associated sounds. Witnesses have stated they discern subtle noises. Also observed with non-triangular UFOs. Electromagnetic effects, a small percentage of cases. There's electrical device failure that's also reported with other UFO sightings.
Yeah.
Multiple triangular UFOs, so in formation. Glowing or colored underside. In some cases, the bottom can have a dull glow that is often reported when it is as reddish in color. Erratic movements. This can take on forms such as zigzag patterns at high speed, quick stops and starts. And then there's something here called blunt end forward movement. In other words, our expectation, I think, going with the arrowhead example, is that the tip would go first.
Yeah.
Right? But sometimes it appears not to. Mm-hmm. And again, that's not the majority of cases. These are more secondary.
Yeah.
Detachable lights. As in a small number of cases, lights and objects have been reported to detach move independently.
Mm-hmm. Some of that's got to be flares.
Mm-hmm.
You would assume some of
that's... Right. And I've heard that as a potential explanation for Phoenix.
Bull crap.
Yeah.
It really is. Like, we've got... The footage I licensed to include in that episode... Mm-hmm. You watched episode 2 already, but there's going to be more, but Phoenix is going to come up a couple times throughout. So that's why, if that episode seems a little light on Phoenix information, that's why. It's basically just setting it up, and then we'll come back to it mm-hmm. a few times throughout. But we have an interview in there in one of the things with like this military Air Force woman who talks about how it was flares. And then, Lynn does a pretty good job of refuting the flare thing, which if you watch any of the actual footage of it doesn't look like flares. You know, they're not, you know, you would expect like different altitudes and like some of them would be blinking out. They're all like a uniform pattern movement perfectly across the city.
Yeah. I remember that being offered as a explanation, even as, you know, when Sightings was a show.
Yeah.
And they had really high quality video of the event. And then they were immediately saying, well, it's flares.
Some of that, I think, is Lynn's. I know Lynn has video and I'm trying to reach out to her about using some of that. What is in our movie right now, I'm not sure what that is. It might actually be it's only three lights. That's why I'm not sure who shot that video that I have. And that was something I was able to license.
Mm-hmm.
But really interesting aspect of the subject.
Yeah, it is. And I don't know, I think the fact that they're large and silent
mm-hmm. makes it creepy.
There's an unsettling quality to that.
Yeah, there really is.
I mean, it's one thing to see a metallic disc zipping around, mm-hmm. but this seems just the weight of that implies is like, I don't know, observation or tracking or something. And that the technology is so far beyond what we think is possible at this point.
You can, first of all, one more time, Triangular UFOs by David Marler. Definitely check the book out. But you can leave us a rating and review on iTunes and wherever you listen to podcasts. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us mail, monsteropolismail@gmail.com. We'll read it on the show. And you can learn more about Small Town Monsters at smalltownmonsters.com. Make sure you write down March 21st. For the official Mysteries and Monsters, a Small Town Monsters event. Our first big event like this since Minerva Monster Day, mm-hmm. 3 years ago? 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. So hope to see some of you guys there, and we'll be back next week. More UFO stuff.
Monsteropolis is proudly presented on Wadsworth Community Radio 97.1 FM or streaming live at wadsworthcommunityradio.com. It is proudly underwritten by Thurber's Jewelers on the Square in downtown Wadsworth.